Hi, I'm Zachary Worrell, and I'm Pedro Salisa's campaign manager.
I'm Gray Delaney, and I am Pedro Salisa's communications director.
Okay, so it's a long way from Virginia. How did you guys get out here?
I was working on a campaign in southwestern Virginia after the Brat Race, and that ended on a Tuesday, and I got a phone call the weekend before that and was on an airplane the next Monday out here. So,
phone call from whom?
From Pedro.
And how did that happen? I mean, he just knew about your track record?
He wanted to beef up the staff and found out that we were available for hire, so have gun, will travel. And we're in Seattle now, and it's absolutely wonderful town and beautiful scenery, too.
Okay, same story or a different story?
Yes, similar. Zach and I worked together with only paid staff on the Dave Brat Race, and Pedro wanted to expand his staff. He really wanted to focus on the ground game, and that's something that we excel at. And we're trying to replicate here, and we're pretty pleased with our progress at this point.
Okay. So I've heard you guys referred to as the political wunderkind. Is that something that you embrace, a title that you embrace?
People like to throw labels on all sorts of things. You know, it's no secret how campaigns are won and lost, and we just follow the book, you know, the proven methodologies of campaigning, and it works. Sometimes it doesn't, but more often than not, it does. So we just are good students, I guess.
Yeah, it's campaigning. It's a lot of work. It's hard work, and it's about direct voter contact. And if you're willing to put in the work, you can be successful. And with the right message, and the traditional consulting class likes to spend a lot of money on TV and radio and direct mail because that's the easy thing to do. But unfortunately, it's not the thing that necessarily works. You got to go speak to people, and you got to get positive word of mouth going, and that is what we're committed to, and that's what wins elections.
You're working for a candidate who almost didn't make it through the primary and really just barely squeaked by. Before we get into the question of what do you do about that, what's your analysis of what went wrong for him?
There were, it was a healthy primary, in my opinion. There was a lot of ideas and personalities discussed. So that's not always necessarily a bad thing to have a very deep and thorough debate about what the issues are for the voters. And, you know, there was some confusion about where Pedro stood on some of the issues, but, you know, we've cleared that up pretty quickly. And so now the base is rallying, and we're finding a lot of independents and moderates are very interested in what Pedro has to say. So,
confusion about immigration, was that the big issue?
That was one of them. You know, people just didn't know where he stood on a lot of the issues, but we're getting the message out there now, and so people are really starting to take to what he has to say. He's a thoughtful, creative person, and people appreciate that.
Was there a sense that he was pro-amnesty? Because, you know, Michelle Malkin and conservative commentators called him an amnesty shill.
Yeah, that definitely happened, and it's unfortunate because it's not his position. So that's, there's just a messaging problem, but we've corrected that pretty well, I believe. So,
okay, what were the other issues?
People have asked, some people think that he's, not pro-gun or he's for socialized medicine, those sorts of things. And it's just not true. I think it's just a general communication issue with the voters.
Yeah, so when you don't define your positions, you allow your opponent to define them for you. And that was the major problem. Pedro has a tremendous life story. He's fulfilled the American dream, but the voters are looking for substance. I mean, our country faces some major, major challenges. And now that we've really fleshed out Pedro's policy positions and where he stands, and put them out to the voters, we're getting an enthusiastic response.
Where do you consider him on the political spectrum? Is he a mainstream Republican? Is he a liberal Republican? I mean, how would you describe his politics?
I'd say he's it's hard to put him into one label because, he definitely differs from the mainstream Republican Party on little caveats here and there and some issues. But, I don't want to say standard Republican because I think that's a bad label. He's a conservative Republican who is open-minded and willing to buck the party when necessary to get things accomplished. So I don't have a good label for him.
When you say he differs from the party on some issues, like what would he differ? I mean, is his stance on immigration any different?
Yeah, there's the Senate bill, the Gang of Eight bill, which Pedro is not in favor of. He believes that the immigration issue is so complicated and there's so many issues that needs to be broken up so we can say, okay, you know what? We've been promised a secure border for 30 years. Hasn't happened. That's something we can all agree on. Let's get that one done. Then we'll move to the next part, which is maybe working on the visa program and the worker allowances, and let's debate that one. Then we'll move on. You know, there are people here that need to be dealt with. Let's figure that out. But the first thing that needs to happen is that secure border. Until that happens, the rest of it's irrelevant, because as Pedro says, we need wide doors, high fences. But without the fences, what's the point of having the doors?
This is a strong differentiation point between him and Congressman Del Bene. She was a co-sponsor of the Senate immigration bill, would have granted amnesty to millions of illegal immigrants. And the problem right now with Republicans and a lot of the American people is they're losing trust in President Obama to enforce the rule of law, and immigration is just another example of that. And so they're fearful that any law that's passed, secure border might be part of the bill, but that part will never come to pass while we grant citizenship to illegal immigrants, and there's other consequences of that bill.
But he also supported the Dream Act or whatever it's called. I can't remember what it's called.
The Real Hope Act.
It was at a point of contention with some Republicans.
Yeah, it was, and Pedro's position is very reasonable on that. Pedro, what they were dealing with is a problem, a symptom of the problem. The problem is we have a lot of illegal immigration. We have a porous border, and Pedro was dealing with the best way he can in Washington, where in Washington there you have illegal immigrants going to high school, and they've been in high school for longer than 3 years. So his argument was, let's make sure they're not going on welfare. Let's give them a strong education, because Pedro believes in a strong education, and then they'll have a less of a cost in society. They'll be taxpayers. They'll be strong proponents of they'll be wealth creators, and they'll be able to fulfill the American dream. And that was the ideal. But we need to fix the problem, because you know he was just fixing a symptom of the problem.
Okay. So you mentioned this a little bit, but what's the strategy going forward? How do you take a candidate who was really kind of in the dumps at the primary and have him win on election night? I mean, what's the strategy?
The strategy is get the ground game going. The ground game, a successful ground game, will beat the air game, so to speak, ads, that sort of thing, 10 times out of 10. If you have a successful ground game, an enthusiastic volunteer base, people spreading, you know, with their coworkers, their neighbors, their family, their friends, if you have people excited about what a candidate has to say and you're effectively disseminating that information, you will win. It doesn't matter how much money interest groups or candidates or campaigns throw at the air.
And what we're this is part of a larger strategy of what we're trying to really move past is the label, the Tea Party label, the Republican label. When you really look at it, you have Susan Delbene was a strong supporter of TARP that rewarded a lot of executives with taxpayer bonuses, paid bonuses. And the farm bill, you know, 33% of the farm bill goes to 4% of the wealthy farmers, the wealthiest farmers. That's not necessarily helping the local farmers in the district. And so what we see here, you see with Obamacare, with big business getting a one-year exemption where individuals and regular taxpayers are not. You see in Congress not having to abide by Obamacare while we do. So what you're seeing is a general frustration among the voter of that they're playing by a different set of rules than we are. And Pedro he's running to represent all voters of the first district, and so the message is being received enthusiastically by a lot of independents as well as conservative Republicans and so-called mainstream Republicans. But we really want to kind of get away from the labels, because I think that kind of pits people together and doesn't allow people to see beyond some of the standard issues.
What's your perception of this district in terms of how challenging it is and in terms of its diversity? I mean, you know, it's pretty geographically, economically, socially, culturally diverse. How do you approach that as a campaign?
Well, what you have to do is you have to remember that the district extends beyond King County, and the voters in Snohomish and Whatcom and Skagit are going to be different in not just ideological terms, but socioeconomic terms, in geographical distribution terms, than they are in King County. And so when you have a multifaceted approach and a ground-based approach with localized people running their campaigns for the communities they know and love, it makes it a lot easier for us. We just say, hey, look, we need to get this message to people in the town of Snohomish. Oh, good, we have a volunteer from the town of Snohomish, been there for 20 years, maybe run for town council, I mean, all sorts of things, and say, you know this county, you know this town, help us get it done. And so it's not a top-down, you know, machine-style election where we're directing this and controlling that and all that sort of stuff. What we're doing is we're empowering local activists to take ownership of this campaign and spread the word as they know best.
So are you basically kind of assuming that King County is going to go to Susan and you've got to look at other geographic areas now?
Oh, no. That's not – I'm not discounting King County at all. It looks like we're going to be pretty competitive there because Pedro is a thoughtful, reasonable person. You know, the Del Bene campaign is going to be screaming Tea Party and extreme and all – you know, just mindless labels trying to scare people. But when people have a chance to speak with Pedro, they see that he's a thoughtful, rational – not an ideologue. You know, he's a very reasonable human being and one that can be trusted. So
when you're dealing with an incumbent, do you also have to make a really strong case that this incumbent has made mistakes and has done a bad job? And I mean, even though she's
well,
a freshman.
Yeah, well, we're saying that Susan Del Bene doesn't even have a really high name ID. I mean, about 20% of the voters are not even aware of who Susan Del Bene is. And so while Pedro, we still have some work to do to get Pedro's name ID up, there is some advantages to her only being in office. This is her first term in office. And this is a swing district in 2012. Three statewide Republican candidates won the first district. You know, that was in a presidential year. So if we can drive the vote out, we have a very good chance. I mean, there's some unrest, and people are very antsy over the state of the economy, the national debt. The unemployment, the real unemployment is over 12%. Too often that number is not reported. So, you know, we've got some major changes and people are looking for a different direction.
How do you deal with the fundraising differential? She's raised close to $2 million. You guys have what, raised less than $500,000? Is that correct?
We're either really close or over $500,000.
Okay. Still.
It's a big difference.
So how do you deal with that?
Well, we dealt with you know, what was it, 20,000% difference in our last campaign. So what you have to do is you just have to be smart and you have to spend money judiciously and you need to really focus on the ground game, which is our specialty and what our plan is. And, you know, the more money we get, that's great, but it doesn't require a high budget campaign to win because the House Majority Leader spent $5 million and lost when we spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $200,000. So.
Oh, that's an even bigger differential.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just too much money in politics. And people, if we continue to get our message out at a reasonable cost, people, that's refreshing. That you don't have to spend several $1 million to win a congressional seat. And Susan Del Bene spent $5 million of her own money over a couple cycles to win the seat in 2012. She's raised well over a couple million this cycle, over half of it from PACs. And so, you know, there is a problem with how much money it takes to be in politics. It discourages a lot of people from running. And so Zach and I are looking to keep that model going of the less money, the better.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels good when you shake hands with someone that, you know, you can tell giving $200 is kind of a big sacrifice, but they believe in the message versus, you know, pack with $20 million to blow on a camp, you know, around the country. It's different. I mean, I'm not discounting the role of PACs. I think that free speech is important. But people appreciate it when you're spending money, you know, in the district and you're spending money from constituents, and it's kind of the ability for people to buy into a campaign. So it's just encouraging to see the amount of support we're getting at the grassroots level, $5, $10, $15 donations. It's pretty spectacular, and it feels good too.
I want to ask you too about your own politics because, you know, when you were hired to come out here, there was a lot of press coverage about that, and you might have higher name ID than Pedro in some circles. But the Del Bene campaign said, just another indication that, you know, Celis is trying to, you know, move to the right. He's got these two Tea Party guys coming out here to run his campaign. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction is I was brought in to win. I was not brought in to change who Pedro is or what he believes in. It's absolutely ridiculous. If you look at what Pedro believes in and all his issue positions on his website and how he speaks, to call him extreme is just, it's borderline a lie. It is just ridiculous and intellectually dishonest to sit there and say that Gray and I, whose political beliefs they don't even really know anything about. They just know who our previous employer was, to say that we're going to come in here and change who Pedro is because, you know, for whatever nonsensical reason they're pushing, it's just offensive. So I hope the voters can see through that.
Yeah, it's, I mean, issues like our $17 trillion debt, $127 trillion of unfunded liabilities, the suffocating regulatory burden. I mean, these are not issues unique to Virginia, to Washington. I mean, these are issues that everyone's facing. So, you know, we didn't come out here and change what Pedro's beliefs are. He's very resolute in his principles. We were just trying to define them and get them out to the voters. And, you know, so, but to say that we're shifting this campaign in one direction or another is just not true. But we are trying to get his message out, and so we hope we're being effective in that.
Have you spent any time looking at the last campaign, at Del Bene's first campaign against John Koster, and what worked and what didn't work there? Because there was, I remember that time there was a lot of hope, you know, among Republicans that this was going to be the year we you know, swing district, new district, we're going to take it, you know, 50-50. And then he really did a lot worse than anyone expected. So are there any lessons to be learned from that, or any contrast that you would paint with your candidate and John Koster?
Yeah, I think Koster was, I've met him. He's a great guy. He's obviously very intelligent. I think that, you know, there are just sometimes campaigns don't play out the way you expect them. In fact, they never do. And they went in with a game plan that looked like it was working, and then last minute it kind of fell apart. So Gray and I are students of sort of tactics and strategies. So we're looking at what the campaign did in the last few weeks and what Susan Del Bene and the Democrats did in the last few weeks. And we're trying to learn everything we can about the way that these elections work here, because, you know, a month-long election day is something foreign to most people in the country, especially, you know, us from Virginia, where there is an election day, people go to the polls. That doesn't happen here. So what we have to do is we have to look at – there's always lessons to be learned in every election. And, you know, I think it's a key indication how the Del Bene and her campaign are going to behave from 2012. So,
yeah, I mean, what the biggest takeaway – I mean, John Koster's polling was showing him dead even through October. And then he had that one comment that was pretty damaging, and the Democrats and Del Bene ran with. And it's unfortunate this campaign didn't stick to the issues, but that seems to be a way politics goes quite often. But, you know, he did a good job of driving the turnout in some areas, not as well in others. So, we've done a pretty thorough and exhaustive study of where he's done, where he did well and where he didn't. And, you know, we're just using those numbers to try to continue to drive our turnout.
One of the things that Koster's campaign complained about afterwards was they didn't get enough support from the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, whatever it's called. What is it?
NRCC.
Yeah. What does that stand for? Congressional?
National Republican Congressional campaign, Committee.
Congressional Committee. Okay. Are you guys getting support from the National Republicans?
Yeah, they've been helping us out, but that's not the end-all be-all. And really, you know, any outside help we can get is great, but our focus is we got the resources at hand in the district. We're going to utilize those to the maximum, and anything else that comes in is icing on the cake. So,
okay. Whose idea was it to do the vote for Pedro?
We inherited that. It, you know, when I first saw it, we're driving up from the airport, and we see a big red sign that says "Vote for Pedro," and we just both look at each other like, I think that's our candidate. And so, you know, at first I was like, oh, that's stupid, that's juvenile, whatever. But it gets people's attention. I hate yard signs with a passion. They don't do anything except for waste time. But people are noticing these signs. And so hopefully what we can do is connect the Vote for Pedro signs. It gets people's attention with the message of, you know, what Pedro stands for. And, you know, brand awareness is always a helpful thing, and the Vote for Pedro signs definitely have increased Pedro's name ID, not necessarily Pedro Solis, but we're working on that, so.
Have you seen the movie?
Oh, of course.
So, my recollection of the movie is that Pedro is kind of a hapless candidate, that he really doesn't have much to say, and that he is elected because his campaign manager, like, busts out some moves, right, on the dance floor. So is that the plan?
Well, the first half is not correct, but the second half, you know, having the campaign team work their butts off and, you know, do a little magic behind the scenes to get Pedro elected. That's absolutely our plan. So, you know, we don't tell people to vote for Pedro because all their wildest dreams will come true. That's just an unrealistic campaign promise that we will not be pushing.
So, you know, you're talking about kind of a brand of retail politics. I mean, just get out there, meet people. This is an enormous district. So how do you do that in a district that's this big?
Well,
most of the vote is along the I-5 corridor. So it's the eastern part of the district is while it's a vast district, a lot of it is national parkland and not that densely populated. So we're actually able to cover most of the district without an extreme amount of traveling and pretty effectively. So while it is territorially, it seems like a huge district. It's not, a lot of it's pretty sparsely populated.
Yeah, it's not too much different from the 7th Congressional District in Virginia, which was large population center and then sort of an exponential decrease in population as you get further away, which is similar to how this district is laid out. And so, you know, we have, like I said, we have people all over the district that we are giving ownership of their territory, and they say, hey, there's an event we need Pedro at. Hey, you know, we need literature and yard signs for this thing. So when you don't try to internalize everything that needs to happen, it makes it much easier to drive the message, get the candidate out there, get the message out there. So,
what's the likelihood that we'll see this campaign or this race go negative? I mean,
I'd say 0%. We're not interested in bashing Susan DelBene as a human being. That's not that is what's disgusting the American people about politics. It turns people off, and if you can't win on the issues, if you can't run a clean campaign and just talk about, you know, what she stands for, what Pedro stands for, her hypocritical stances on certain things, if you can't win based off those things, then that's not a campaign I want to be a part of. I don't like dragging people's name through the mud and doing character assassination. That's just the politics that's making America sick of politics.
Yeah, it depends on how you define negative. I think issue-based negative attacks are a service to the voter, but when you're attacking their character, when you're attacking maybe their wealth or this connection or that connection, personal connections, you're bringing their family into it, that's when it crosses the line. But, you know, to point out their votes or and things like that, I mean, that is completely fair and should be part of the how a voter makes up their mind. But we're going to be running an issue-based campaign, and I'll point to one big difference here. We're at an $18 trillion debt, and I know a lot of people, you know, it's a tough number to grapple with, but when President Obama took office, it was about $90,000 per taxpayer. Now it's well over $150,000 per taxpayer, and that's with interest rates being very low. So if interest rates go up, I mean, we're going to be paying more and more of our federal budget just towards interest payments on our national debt. So that's an issue that Pedro is committed to tackling. That's why he supports a balanced budget amendment. Susan DelBene supports the Buffett rule. Well, it's nice to talk about a balanced approach, but the Buffett rule would raise $3.2 billion a year. It would take over 200 years just to pay off the 2013 deficit alone with that figure. So clearly that's not the solution. That's may do well in focus groups, but we really do need elected officials that are want to tackle these issues and move past some of this rhetoric, because you know, that's why we're involved in politics. That's why Pedro's involved, because very committed to tackling some of the biggest issues facing our country, and the debt is a major one.
I was just going to say, some people are attacking Pedro because he declined to give specific numbers that he wants to decline specific programs about. But that's the wrong approach. What we need to do is, as Gray mentioned, through a balanced budget amendment, it forces Congress to have discussions about what can be cut. If you roll into Congress saying, we're going to cut everything by 20% across the board, that doesn't get anything accomplished. You know, what we have to do is we have to say, okay, look, we're balancing the budget over 5 years or whatever the amendment would require. So, look, there's a compelling argument for all this education spending. There's a compelling argument for spending money on this. There's a compelling argument for the Department of Defense spending. And what we're going to have to do is figure out where everything lies in our list of priorities as a nation and move from there. So I think it's kind of unfair for people to be hollering at Pedro for declining to give, I'm going to cut X amount of money from this and X amount of money from that and X amount of money from this. That's not the role of a candidate. He's not on the budget or appropriations committee. You know, that's a discussion to be had in committee and then on the floor. Not.
But the main point is you need to force Congress's hand, because as we've seen with the fiscal cliff deal, everything, it's always a crisis. The debt limit. I mean, Congress never acts unless it's the last minute. So you have to pass a law like the balanced budget amendment in order to force Congress's hand, and then they're going to have to comply with that law, and they're going to have to come up with something.
Well, maybe, so, because they don't seem to follow much of the Constitution anyway. But